Maharal lived in the beginning of the modern world, early modern, the beginning of modern astronomy in an accurate form starts around the time of the Maharal, Tycho Brahe and Johann Kepler. Have you heard of these guys? Brahe and Kepler? Okay, at least some of us have heard of them. My father always says that they're real scientists. They spent decades making daily observations. And
planetary motion
yes, planetary motion, constellation motion.
Right. Other things don't take that long.
Yeah, no, but see, the point is, and after thousands of observations, they came up with certain rules, or attempted to. Wait a second. So I once told him that there was one of the early Chachmei Yerushalayim, in modern times, that means post 1800, was Rabbi Yosef Schwartz, Rabbi Jehoseph Schwartz. He made, I believe the number is 2,000. Observations to show that the difference between Shkia, between sunset in the old city, and on the top of Har Zeisan ranges between 3 and 4 minutes. That's what we call real science, when you have a real body of data. When you're lacking in your body of data,
you only need 15 data points scientifically.
When you're lacking in your body of data, then your science afterwards is going to be less clear. Okay. But anyway, the Maharal had a Talmud whose name was Rav David Ganz. And it's a known fact that he was, quotes, an associate friendly with Tycho, with Brahe and Kepler. Now, at a similar point, and it's definitely related, this is the era of the Reformation. Now, I'm not sure why. I sort of do know why, but I'm still not sure. In the larger terms, I'm not. There's like a sort of feeling out there perpetuated by secular Jewish writers or quasi-secular Jewish writers that Reformation was a very good thing, etc., etc., etc. Maybe you've noticed it. We'll see a little more about it. In terms of the Maharal, though, it's important because Reformation is historically seen as the beginning of rational thought, at least in the world at large. Now, all around this time, now something else happened also at this time. And that is that Spain conquered Portugal. Now, conquered is not really the right word. That's like oversimplifying. The king of Spain inherited Portugal due to his claims on the throne. Spanish and Portuguese really don't get along at all, for the records. Portuguese hating Spanish a lot. However, due to a number of specific reasons, which no reason to get into over here, the Portuguese were willing to recognize the King of Spain as King of Portugal. So that had a major effect on Portuguese Murano Jewry and Portuguese Crypto Jewry. As I mentioned a couple of months ago when we were speaking about it, even though they forced Portuguese Jews to convert and didn't even give them the rights to leave in 1497, the Portuguese were much more lax about enforcing anything. And they even initially told the Jews, listen, do what you want for the next 20 years, and as long as you're not doing it in public, we're not going to say anything. Now, one is curious, and I haven't been able to quantify, up until what point were Portuguese Muranos knowledgeable of Hebrew? And like the irony of all of this is because this is the era of humanism and the beginning of rationalism. Hebrew was considered an educated language, and humanists, by definition, knew Hebrew. So it's I'm unclear, and I'm unclear at what point, up to what point, Portuguese Jews still fluent in Hebrew. They're still, some of them at least, able to read and understand Hebrew. It's an interesting question. So again, so initially the Portuguese government doesn't really care that much. There was a flurry of persecutions around Shlomo Malchus, early 1530s, in which a sizable amount of them left, which is why that caused the whole Smicha problems, the whole Smicha controversies in the late 1530s. But still, the majority it quieted down, and the rule was, the rule of Portugal was that things were quiet. That's all until the Spanish conquered Portugal. The Spanish take over Portugal, they import the Spanish Inquisition. By definition, if the Spanish king rules Portugal, I'm not even sure if he needed papal permission. Yeah, initially there was the Spanish Inquisition in Castile. Spain's really, it's really a term, it's not a state at the time. Because it really divided into four sections: Castile, Aragon, and Valencia, and Portugal. And it happened to be all ruled by the same person. Castile, Aragon, Valencia really felt the same, but Portugal didn't. And I know that the Spanish king needed official rights from his pope. He needed papal dispensation, a right to import Spanish Inquisition from Castile to Aragon, and the people in Aragon were not happy about it. But they managed to push it over and push it through anyway. And in terms of Portugal, I'm not clear. I didn't read anything accurate enough to see if that's what happened. Anyway, whatever happened is, the facts are, is they imported the Spanish Inquisition to Portugal in the early, mid-1570s. Now, that was a big problem, because as Portuguese Jews, again, most of the one, unlike the Jews who stayed in Spain, who stayed there by their own, they made the choice. Portuguese Jews weren't given a choice, and many of them just left Spain. So they're a much more committed body of Jews. Now they're faced with the real Inquisition, so it's like two things happened. Some of them moved to Spain, and ironically, because the Spanish were worried about Portuguese problems, they were more on their feet and had their eyes open in Portugal than they did in Spain. So a lot of them moved from Spain to Portugal because they're legally now the same country, more or less. And there was large quotes crypto Jews, Muranos and crypto Jews in Spain from 1580 up until 1650 at least, not even later. Now, also, a lot of them started leaving, and many of them went to the Netherlands. Now, but what's important in terms of us, in terms of the morale, why am I talking about this in the middle of speaking about the morale? What is important in terms of the morale is you have Jews who were assimilated into non-Jewish society for a significant amount of time, leaving non-Jewish society, coming back to Jewish society. And most of them were literate, many of them were educated, and had been exposed to Western culture, science, etc., etc. That's not the right word. They weren't exposed; they were part of it. So you have, this is the beginning of the modern confrontation of Torah science, Torah versus science, or Torah rationalism, etc., 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 is all coming in this era at the times of the Maharal. The Maharal was most specifically motivated. He specifically addressed the points more than once. He was specifically motivated by someone by the name of Azariah. He's either called Azariah Min Ha'adumim or Azariah Di Rossi. Rossi, meaning red in Latin. And Adumim also means red. Anyway, Azariah Di Rossi, or Min HaAdumim, wrote a sefer called Morei Naim, very interesting book, a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of history, a little bit of this, that, and the next. It's an interesting book in which he examines historical, accuracy of Divrei Chazal. Historical accuracy of Divrei Chazal, and does not always conclude that Chazal were historically accurate. Yeah. obviously, modern academics and intellectuals will tell you clearly Azari de Rossi was a proto-Moscow. That's what they'll tell you about him. They say that about other people also. They said that about Yasha from Candia, and that's definitely not true. I would say 100% sure about that, but Yasha from Candia, he's also said that these are all products. Azari de Rossi himself was actually, he was Migrushe Sfar. He's from a family that left Spain, but they weren't, he was in Italy, but it may be Amsterdam. But that's one body of Jewish society. And the Maharal is like Ki'ilu, part of official response. Now, I mean, for example, we have a lot of very fascinating, interesting Gemaras. I'll give you one of them that many people have heard of. I mean, one of them. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch for the records. Okay. It says, if you see the piece of the tour, the mountain that Og ripped up to hold over the Jewish people, you can make a bracha, Sha'asa Nisim Lavasin Abba Malka Reza. Okay? That's the Gemara. Three more brachas than the brachas.
Apologize.
I got your apology on the records also. Okay. How do you understand a Gemara like that? Do you understand a Gemara like that literally? And there's not one Gemara like that. There are many Maimari Chazal like that. How do you understand a Gemara like that? The Maharal is considered one of... I mean, the Rishonim, it's hard. I mean, Rashi says, you know what, I'll give you a different Gemara. What are we doing tomorrow? I'm in Rabbi David's room. I have Shas at my fingertips. But over here, you're stuck, and I remember approximately where it is, but not exactly. Okay. There is a story in the Sefer Shmuel about the Plishtim capturing the Ara. This is a story in Sefer Shmuel. What?
Hemorrhoids.
Not to hemorrhoids. After the hemorrhoids, what happens?
They give it back.
People who stay with the schedule. Oh, I forgot to do that. Okay, Sean, you know we're going to have email Dove tonight. Okay. Maybe I'll just leave it on his desk. Okay, so it says that when they brought they sent the Aaron back. They sent it with the cows. Okay. It says Vayusharna Haparos, which means the cows went straight. Now Chazal Darshan Vayusharna is also Shiva. They sang. What did they sing? It says Gemara Avodah Zarah, Son of the Beis. I think it's Chav Gimel or Chav Dalad of the Beis, but I'm just remembering. Somewhere over there, five opinions of the Gemara, what Shira they said. Now, if you learn the Gemara simply, it sounds like those cows got up and started singing. Roni, Roni, Roni. That's what it sounds like. Now, and one could say, if you look at Rashi here, and I want some share on this, but one could look at the Rashis, and it sounds like Rashi takes the Gemara literally. That's what it sounds like. The Maharal says the whole thing's symbolistic, the whole thing's allegorical, and it certainly did not literally happen. I mean, Ki'ilu, the Raya in Chazal, that didn't happen, as Chazal talk about the Pi'asa, they talk about Bilam's donkey talking, and that being very novel and Mechudosh, and they don't mention anything about his cows. So that's like Ki'ilu, an internal Raya in Chazal.
Why do people have difficulty with the cows singing if Bilam's donkey can talk?
Because Bilam's donkey can talk, it says explicitly in Ovos, is one of the excellent things created by the Shmushas. That's considered
right,
a special exception.
But as I'm saying, as far as the person would view Tanakh, if he can accept the fact that Bilam's donkey can talk, he could also accept the fact that the cows can sing.
Okay, but the point is the Pasuk doesn't say that. Pasuk says, Vasharna Paras, Chazal Darsh, doesn't just mean that they went straight, it also means that they sang. So do you learn a Gemara like this literally? So the Maharal, they're on a long piece. It's allegorical, blah, 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 blah. It's X, Y, and Z. All sorts of very, lofty ideas. the Maharal throws around, and at the very end of it, he tacks on as like a side comment, and it's obvious they didn't literally sing. Let's take this Gemara literally. Okay, there's a slew of Gemaras about Shlomo and Ashmadoi, Shlomo and the king of the Shechem. Maharal's a very long piece of explaining it, and there he tacks on at the end again. He tacks on a side comment at the end. And it's obvious. I don't have to explain to you that you don't not to learn this Gemara literally. So this is this. In a sense, you know, I wouldn't. The Maharal himself is complicated, and in terms of what I say, like the flow of Jewish thought, he's closest to the Rishonim, to the Ramban, but he's not quite the Ramban. He's closest to the Ramban in like these type of issues. But you know, to borrow from the Rambam, who many people claim to be inspired by, the Rambam says, you see a Chazal like this and you don't understand it, or it doesn't make any sense to you. He's supposed to say, there must be something where I'm lacking intelligence, I don't understand the depth of what Chazal want, and you shouldn't have to make fun of Chazal. And the Maharal, I've never, you know, I'll be honest, that Zariyati Minatumim, Zariyati Rossi's book I never read, so I don't feel I could say anything about it. But the Maharal definitely felt that Azayit Min HaDumim was Pogea, was infringing on Chazal's, you know, who they were. And he wrote, he attacks Azayit Min HaDumim many times in quite sharp ways. Okay. Let's go on. There are also here, I'll give you a different example. There's also like, this is again, because this is the time of Kepler and Bra, this is what I call the beginning of modern science. Scientifically it's considered the beginning of modern science. It's important to understand that there's, that, you know, the body of Jewry at this point is living in Poland. The body of European Jewry is living in Poland from 1600, but maybe even earlier. The majority of all Jews in Europe live in Poland. And once you hit 1700, it's not just the majority, it's a large majority of all Jews live in Poland. It is important to realize the Polish Jewry is more isolated than the rest of European Jewry for two reasons. One reason is that they live in Poland, and Polacks, as we know, are not the world's most intelligent people. Now, it is true that Copernicus was Polish. That is true. But he's like the exception to the rule. Yeah, that's right, that's true. And because they live in Poland, Jews in Poland are more, they're isolated, A, in terms of the people they live near are, you know, not that educated. B, is Polish Jewry is much more substantial and forms, you know, a community in and of itself. What?
Ghettos.
Well, they weren't official ghettos. You know, in Poland, the point was, I mean, there were cities that had the rights to exclude Jews, but Jews, generally speaking, had the rights to live places. But the Jews themselves, A, their first language was Yiddish. If they spoke Polish, it was with an accent. If they were dealing with the more educated element, they spoke to them in German/Yiddish. So contact was limited. And again, the Murano issue, which is very strongly felt in Central Western Europe, in terms of Italy, Holland, and in northern Germany, didn't exist in Poland almost at all. I mean, there was no Murano.
Germany had Murano?
No. They had former Muranos. This is later. This is already starting in the 1600s. But Hamburg had a very, very large Sephardi community. Hamburg, which is, you know, one of the great German kihilas. Okay. So, the Maharal again The Maharals are the beginning of modern science, and the basics of how the Maharal answers questions in science in terms of what was known and what wasn't known is his basic thrust of his answer is that Chazal are talking about ultimate cause and science is not talking about ultimate cause. And what do I mean by that? So I'll give you an example. Newton is really credited with formulation of the laws of gravity. That's what Newton's credited with. And he was really working with Brahe, Kepler, and Galileo, Copernicus, everyone else's previous work, but he's the one who really formulated everything in a very clear form. And as my father always says, we can tell you a lot about gravity. We can talk about it a lot extensively. No one's going to tell you why gravity works. That's not within the realm of what's possible for science to describe and understand. As a matter of fact, we care why if we can reproduce it, but why is not necessarily and many times not pertinent at all a question for science. Why this happens? Who cares why it happens? It happens. Let's see what's happening and describe it as best as possible. The Maharal understands many Agadotas, many of these Dibrei Chazal talking about phenomena in the world. They're not speaking in a scientific fashion of describing the what is going on. Rather, they're going down to the core of the ultimate why. Why should such a thing happen? Why does Hashem want this, mechanism, this structure to happen? That's like the basic. That's a basic idea the Maharal gives over. And these, scientific issues which started around his time. Okay. In the world at large, and according to popular history, the Maharal is best known for the Golem. Right? That's what everyone knows about him. The real question is there a real historical substance to the Maharal having made a Golem or not? What do you say there, Rimmer?
No.
Rimmer says no. Okay. Now, let's put things in perspective. The Gemara explicitly in more than one place talks about making a golem.
Counting a golem
for a minyan is the tshuva of a chacham tzvi.
It's not in the Gemara?
It's not in the Gemara. And we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Can you count a golem for a minyan? I'll talk about that. Just get me paid. Let's go piece by piece and get through this piece by piece as in order as we could do. Okay. Now, it's important to realize that these issues are what's called in Jewish terms, Kabbalah Mises. Kabbalah Mises means...
It's Baba Mises.
What?
It's a Baba Mises.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's Bamish. Kabbalah Mises. Can you guys slow down? Let me go through this piece by piece. Kabbalah Mises means practical Kabbalah. Means using it in an actual form. How do you use Kabbalah in an actual form? So the answer is you use it via contemplation and ki'ilu manipulation of certain shenis. People who did this, do you know what someone who engaged in Kabbalah Mises was called? Does anyone have any idea? People who engaged in Kabbalah Mises were called
Kabbalists.
What? Not Kabbalists. Balei Shem.
Oh, like the Baal Shem Tov.
Aha! Very good. Remember, as soon as the Yiddish comes out, like the Baal Shem Tov. Very good. Someone who engaged in Kabbalah Mises, in practical Kabbalah, was called a Baal Shem. The Baal Shem Tov was called the good Baal Shem, and the reason why is because as you guys suspect, everyone who engaged in Kabbalah Mises is not the most, finished, polished characters. I'm not saying... you have to balance things out. In other words, Rav Chaim Vital is one of the big guns and the Kabbalah system, engage in Kabbalah Mises. How much, I haven't had time. There's controversy about which Svarim, which talk about Reb Chaim Vital using Kabbalah Mises are accurate, which ones aren't accurate. I didn't have the time to investigate it properly. I actually know somebody who spent, in my opinion, a lot of time, maybe too much time, working on this question. But there's no question that it did exist, and there's no question that Reb Chaim Vital did engage in Kabbalah Mises. Now, there are two very important prerequisites for Kabbalah Mises. And one is that you have to be pure enough. You have to, if you're not Ish Kadosh, a holy person, then it's a known thing, historically is documented more than once. People who engage in Kabbalah Mises and ended up in really bad straits. It's a very immense controversy. I'm going to dangle this one out at you. There was someone. I don't have the right sefer in front of me right now, but I'm pretty sure his name was Rabbi Avraham Abulafia. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia lived in the times of the Rajba, and definitely engaged in Kabbalah Mises, in practical Kabbalah, and using Kabbalah in a real way. The Rajba, from what we could tell, the Rajba held he became highly deluded, and I didn't have. See, I have to look things over very carefully. You know, like, and a lot of these sources of these things are not the world's most accurate things. Like the Tshuva Sarajba is an accurate source. It's like a very, very accurate source. A lot of the other stuff about it is not nearly as accurate. But according to the sources I read, and basically from a basically accurate source, Rabbi Avraham Abulafia, before the end of his life, thought he was a prophet, etc., etc., etc. That's what he thought. So Kabbalah Mises could definitely be dangerous. Of course, the other prerequisite is you have to, besides being a holy person, you have to have the proper and accurate knowledge. And that leads us on to the question: what about the Maral? What about the Maral? The Maral have access to Kabbalah Mises? Probably. There were a Baal Shem floating around. It's hard to know. You know, the feeling you get from Kisvei Maral is he probably wouldn't have engaged in it. It's like I mentioned last week, I believe, but if not the week before, it's quite unlikely that the Maral knew about the Arizal. I mean, he probably knew about him, but about the Ari and his Kabbalah, it's not that likely. I don't know enough of the Ramak. I know almost nothing about the Ramak in real sense to know if the Maharal is influenced by the Ramak or not. It's definitely possible. It's definitely possible and probable that the Maharal had seen the Maharak, the Ramak, Ramush, Kotavari, Sefer, Pardes Rimonim. That's very possible and probable. But the Maharal, again, the Maharal published. He published Gur Aryeh before Pardes Rimonim was published in 1573, and he was already clearly a Talmud Chacham of stature. And the ideas, in other words, the what they call in Hebrew makbilot, which means recurrent themes and repeated themes. The differences between Gur Aryeh and later Svarim of the Maral are almost not. There's almost no difference. There's just they work. It's not mashma that the Maral found out about something later on in his life, which changed his understanding of Kabbalah. And because, therefore, we know that the Maral, you know, we know what the Maral thought in 1572, 1573, including Gur Aryeh, I don't personally think that the Maral was much influenced by the Kabbalah of the Ari and the Ramak, even though it's impossible to prove one way or the other. Okay, would the Maral engage in Kabbalah Mises? You can't prove one way or the other. You can't prove one way or the other. Now, the last question, of course, is, was he, you know, pure enough, holy enough to do it? It's difficult to say he wasn't. Simply stated, it's a well-known fact. You listening to this, Remor?
Yep.
It's a well-known, you know, Masora, as we say, tradition amongst, in Lita, Lithuania, that the Vilna Gaon held he himself could have made. The Vilna Gaon held on himself that he could have made a golem before the age of 13. However, he wasn't. He didn't feel it was proper or necessary. In other words, one of the conditions of engaging the golem is dangerous, even for someone who can't tell. There's clear danger involved, but if there's real tzara, there's real necessity, then one can do such a thing. So again, subtotal. Could the Maharal have made a golem? Probably. It's impossible to say clearly one way or the other, but probably. Did the Maharal make a golem? Okay, that's the next step. Okay. There's not absolute evidence that the Maharal did not make a golem. However, there is very strong evidence that he didn't. Even though it's not absolute, it's very strong. The Maharal's Talmud of David Gans, who writes over all sorts of stories of the Maharal, doesn't mention the golem. The Chacham Tzvi, who is also a great-great-great-grandson of the Maharal, about 5 or 6 generations, he has that famous tshuva about can you include a golem in a minyan? And he says he had a grandfather who, I don't remember what his grandfather's name was, I think he had a grandfather who made a golem, but he doesn't mention the Maharal, who's also a different great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of his having made a golem. So that's what we call strong circumstantial evidence that the Maharal did not make a golem, because the Chacham Tzvi, who is a descendant from the Maharal, and it's the honest truth is it's not that. Historically speaking, the Chacham Tzvi died around 1720-1730, which is only 100-something years after the death of the Maharal. And I know today we look at 100 years as a very long period of time, but back in early modern times, 100 years was not that long at all.
French.
What?
French.
Second? Right, that's right. So, it's again, this is not absolute proof, but it's very strong. Now, the strongest real proof that he didn't make a golem was like this. Have any of you guys ever read any of the stories of the Maharal and the golem? No?
Not the cartoon?
Not the cartoon. There's Gershon Winkler? You never read that? The Golem? No, you guys never read that one? Okay, fine. It was printed in the mid-late 70s. Stories of the Maharal's Golem. They were written, unfortunately didn't write down the guy. I don't have the guy's name down anywhere. I didn't have time to pull it out of anything. I don't remember if it's Rosen. I think it's Rosenbaum, but maybe it's Rosenberg. Maybe I'm even misremembering the Rosen part. Anyway, there was a rabbi who lived in America between approximately 1890 and 1930. Who wrote the stories, the official stories of the golem from Prague. He wrote the official stories, about the Maharal making the golem, and all sorts of interesting things, and, the blood libels, and sending the golem to do this, and sending the golem to do that. I'm sure you guys have heard, the cartoons are based on that. Okay? So, he claims, let's go through it like in order, because I think that makes it more, entertaining. He claims that he found these stories in a manuscript that he found in a certain, certain city in Europe, and in the church library. Okay, the city doesn't exist, and the church doesn't exist
anymore.
Ever. Now, so people say, I read an article about 15 years ago saying, going through this. I don't remember which one of the riots. I remember they brought this riot, and they said a forger. He made the whole thing up! Okay, now, this fellow, whose name again I think was Rosenbaum, but maybe it was Rosenberg, maybe it was one, something else also, he wrote an autobiography a little before he died in 1930. And in his autobiography, he listed everything he wrote. He listed.
Put it under fiction.
That's right. He listed fiction and non-fiction. In other words, he had Ver Tvachan Chumash on Mishnah, he had Shalas and Shuvas, and he had fictional works. And amongst his fictional works are listed the stories of the golem from Prague. So it's not shot, it's a forgery, by the way. It's right. He wrote it purposely as a fictional work. And his hint to everyone that it's fictional was he found it in a fictional place. That's the real truth. In other words, the article I read 15 years ago, the guy obviously didn't know that this fellow, the guy who wrote the famous stories of the Golem from Prague, he left a hint in the way he wrote it that it wasn't really true. Okay. Fine, let's go on. Okay. Now, we're at a very key critical point. We're at a very critical point here. Up until 1550 or so, approximately, Central Western Europe, Jews are being expelled from one place to another, starting with England, France, Spain. Then the Germans got into it. The Germans started in the 1430s, started getting into it. And Jews are slowly being expelled from almost all of Central and Western Europe. This period in time, and the morale plays a part in it, which I'm going to get into tonight. This is a period in time where things start changing. One of the most important rules in terms of maintaining a Jewish community is economic viability. That's a very basic rule. And, you know, we take it very for granted. You know, today when we talk about economic problems, we talk about, you know, we're concerned with American economic problems. But, you know, even though theoretically everyone's, you know, treated, you know, equally under one America, we certainly know that's not completely true. It's not completely true. I mean, I'm sure we're aware that the quota system that the Ivy League schools invented in the early 1900s were invented almost explicitly to keep Jews out of Ivy League universities. Yes, we're aware of that? Okay, maybe not. Okay.
I knew.
You're aware of that? Okay, that's a fact. I mean, more or less. It's a more or less. So, the economic restrictions and or lack of economic restrictions play a very large part in determining how Jewish communities are going to develop, etc., etc. And the whole entire period of the Balitosis and Jews in France was basically the result of the French government not merely allowing Jews to do banking, to lend with interest, but also backing their loans, as we spoke about months and months ago. So now, what's going on now, you know, the big event of the 15th century is the Protestant Reformation. And again, I sort of do know why, but it's like very ironic, you know. Secular Jewish historians, generally speaking, are pro-Reformation, which is of course ironic because Martin Luther, the one who started the Reformation, was an absolutely rabid anti-Semite. You know, just briefly for the historical purposes, just a brief historical blurb. He initially blamed the Catholics, the Catholic Church, for lack of being able to convert Jews. He said the reason why is because he persecuted them. If you want to persecute them, they'll all convert right away. So he said, don't persecute them. So they didn't. So Jews still didn't convert. So then Martin Luther turned into one of the most rabid anti-Semites, and he openly encouraged, and more than encouraged, like, you know, wrote to different princelings, princes and princelings in Germany, chiding them for not expelling their Jews. And as a result of Martin Luther's rabid anti-Semitism, there was a spurt of expulsions in the 1520s. That's what happened, ki'ilu. So initially it didn't help that much. But what did help was it created an atmosphere of intellectual confusion. Now, especially in Germany. Now, people who are sort of historical think of Germany as being divided between, you know, the northern and western Germany, northern and eastern Germany are historically Protestant, and southern and western Germany, the Rhine area, while going through Bavaria, over southern Germany, Austria, and that whole area is always considered Catholic. Now that is true post the 30 Years' War. But before the 30 Years' War started in 1618. But before the 30 Years' War, the facts are, is most of Germany, if it wasn't Protestant, it was strongly Protestant leaning. It was strongly Protestant leaning. And, you know, there's a very basic rule of human society, is that, you know, is that people are affected by people around them. That's a very, very basic rule. And as a result of the majority of Germans being Protestant, let's say by 1550, or Protestant leaning, you know, the rulers of Germany, even if they were Catholic, were isolated. And this led to many rulers converting to changing to Protestantism. And most specifically, even, you know, we again, historically speaking, people think of the Habsburgs as being, you know, reactionary Catholics. However, there was a period between 1550 and 1610 that they weren't at all that way. Specifically, Maximilian II and Rudolf II were no more than ambivalent about Catholicism. And both of them showed a certain amount of favor towards the Jews. Even, in other words, even Charles V, who was also king of Spain from about 1510 until 1550. And in Spain and also in the Netherlands, he strictly enforced the Inquisition. In Germany, he never did because he couldn't afford to. Because in Germany, he needed Jewish help, Jewish money, in terms of you know, counteracting and balancing the Protestant, the Protestant revolt and rebellion against him. So the, you know, specifically speaking, Rudolf II. I mean, it's probable that Maximilian did something. He definitely, it's a definitely known fact that he visited the Prague ghetto or the Jewish quarter in 1571. But Rudolf II, who I don't remember if it's his son or it's a or if it's a grandson or if it's a nephew, because the Habsburg dynasty was very complicated. It was very, very complicated. I don't want to get those complications. They're definitely not part of a Jewish history class. But Rudolf II removed an immense amount of restrictions on the Jews, allowing them to more or less engage in almost anything. You know, before that, the guilds, all crafts were ruled by guild rules, and whether that's tailoring, whether that's shoemaking, whether that's, you know, metalworking, goldsmithing, you know, dealing in jewelry, all this was controlled by guilds before Rudolf II, and Jews were not allowed to do it. And he allowed the Jews. It's fascinating because the guilds still operated for the non-Jews. He didn't say that the guilds don't exist. The guilds weren't dismantled until 1800. The guilds weren't dismantled until Napoleon. However, he allowed Jews to be outside the system and compete. Now, that is very important because that lays the path that prepares the way for Jews gaining rights in Europe, which starts in the 1600s. The way is prepared by Rudolf II. In a more, you know, like not in a systematic fashion, but in a personal way, taking restrictions off of Jews, and led to the rise of the first of what should be called the first proto-court Jew, whose name was Marcus Mizels. Marcus Mizels left over 500,000 florins when he died, which I don't know exactly how much that is in modern terms, but apparently that's an unbelievable amount of money. He was so financially important to Rudolf II that Rudolf II gave him personal protection. In other words, all Jews had certain rules which applied to them. But they weren't really citizens. I don't know if he was mamish made a citizen or not, but he came fairly close to it. And as a result of this, as a result of all this, Prague, which in the early 1500s had less than 100 Jews living in it, by 1600 had over 3,000 Jews living in it. Over 3,000 Jews who, you know, ranged, but of course some of them were poor, but many of them had a decent amount of money, and this creation of a Jewish network in different cities is very critically important. We're not going to get there this year. Critically important for developments in the 30 Years' War and afterwards. Because Rudolf II was the Holy Roman Emperor, he was, again, the legal ruler of Germany, and other Germans, to an extent, followed his lead. Pashtus, I was not able to verify 100%, but Pashtus not as much, but definitely minimally in Frankfurt, for example, which in 1560 had less than 500 Jews in it, also by 1610 had around 3,000 Jews, which was a very substantial Jewish community. In those times, those were from the outside of Istanbul, out of Constantinople, and Baghdad. These were the largest Jewish communities in the world. So this is all a result of Rudolf II, who was quite ambivalent about Catholicism, favoring Jews and allowing, you know, opening up economic opportunity to Jews. It is a fact that Rudolf II met with the Maharal, invited the Maharal to his palace in 1593. That's a fact. He invited the Maharal, that was fascinating. He invited the Maharal to his palace. I don't know. There's no known record of what the Maharal thought of it. It would definitely be fascinating if someone would have something to say about it, but nothing that I really know about. Anyway, fine.